Hello. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. And let's start with the book that my family gave me when I turned 80 that's entitled 80 Things to Do When You Turn 80. But know that these suggestions are really good for folks who are not 80. Today I'm going to read you an essay entitled Recovering from Injury and Illness. It's up to me, it's up to you. And this is by Morton H. Shevitz, Ph.D., ABPP. He's a psychologist, author, and consultant. After a month of denial and uncertainty, I agreed to have a surgery to address my severe back pain and decreasing ability to walk. My surgeon did a really good job, managing to remove the herniated disc with limited invasion and no fusion of vertebrae. However, while the surgery was successful, I was woefully disabled. Getting in and out of bed without further injury to my back involved a complex series of maneuvers, rolling onto my side, pushing up with my arms, and onto a walker. I needed help dressing, bathing, and going to the toilet. Everything was a challenge. Everything was new, and everything was hard. With no appetite, I lost more than 20 pounds, and sadly, all of it muscle mass. I had difficulty sleeping, cycles of mild to moderate pain, and felt totally helpless for the first few weeks. Thanks to careful planning and Medicare, a physical therapist came to the house and slowly got me upright and moving. By the way, physical therapy is covered by Medicare, but your physician must order it. After a few weeks, it became clear the skills of my physician and team were responsible for a successful surgical outcome. My surgeon was enthusiastically optimistic. You'll be up and about in a couple of weeks, walking in a month, and driving again in 2 months, and back to yourself in 3. Ha! No way did that happen. It became abundantly clear that I needed to be the responsible party and not assume that things would get better on their own. Partially mobile, I sat on a walker. Oh, still on a walker, but able to get around, I began searching for a physical therapist and visiting different settings. I found the right person in the acting associate director of the UCSD Outpatient Physical Therapy Program. After an assessment, a program consisting of twice a week supervised physical therapy in the outpatient clinic, 5 days of at-home exercises, and daily walking, first with a walker, then a cane, and then on my own, was prescribed. Important. Any physical therapist that starts out working with you before they've done a thorough assessment should be avoided. For decades, I had been focused on helping medical patients address their long-term chronic health problems, such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and yes, postpartum disabilities via behavior change. The research on patient follow-through is actually quite dismal. 1 in 3 patients does not get their prescription filled, and of those who do, only around half take their medications as prescribed. And this is easy. Just take your medicine. When we look at the more difficult behaviors like regular exercise, sleep, hygiene, food volume and type, weight loss, and stress reduction, follow-through is even worse. Part of this, I believe, is due to the current paradigm, which talks about patient compliance and patient adherence. Frankly, I don't think these are useful concepts. No one that I know wants to adhere or comply. Most people don't like to be told what to do. A more compelling concept is patient empowerment, which the World Health Organization defines as a process in which patients understand their role, are given the knowledge and skills by their health care provider to perform a task in an environment that recognizes community and cultural differences and encourages patient participation. So, it was up to me. I want to say that I'm not a jock and I've never been one. As a matter of fact, I was significantly overweight as a child and adolescent. Aside from being a physically large presence on the line of an intramural football team, I did not play team sports in high school or college. Even as an adult, I didn't begin exercising till I was in my late 30s, and that was to accompany my newly pregnant wife on her daily walks so she could have a healthy pregnancy. And it worked for her. But what I was doing then was relatively easy and totally pain-free. After my back surgery, what was asked of me was very, very, very difficult, and at times quite painful. I was having difficulty standing, sitting, walking, and balancing. But I found that after I started doing what I was asked to do, I began to feel better, stronger, and more in control of my life. So I had a choice: do nothing and hope for the best, or begin taking slow steps forward. So what happened? Eventually, I was able to throw away my cane. Eventually, I was able to dress myself. Eventually, I was able to step into a shower, stand on my own, and step out to dry myself. Eventually, I was able to get back to a number of projects that I was working on and complete a book on aging with Ken Blanchard. That's refirebook.com. Eventually, I began to rebuild my clinical and consulting practice. Eventually, I was able to fly to New York and to Eugene, Oregon to visit my other two adult children. Understand, this was not a superhuman feat. I was simply fortunate enough to have a good outcome from the surgeries, make a commitment to recovery, and was, and still am, living a happy life filled with friends, family, and meaningful things to do. So I say again, it's up to me, it's up to you, and it's up to each of us to do whatever we can to make a difference. Learn what you need to do to get better and do it. Take charge of your recovery. By taking action, you get to determine, in part, what that future will look like. Now we're moving on to the Mayo Clinic magazine, Understanding Alzheimer's, Your Guide to Brain Health. So today I'm going to cover a few sidebar articles that have been in the articles that we've been reading about inside your brain and typical aging. So we'll start with one, neurons, your brain's messengers. Nerve cells, neurons, are the basic units of your nervous system. In your brain alone, you have about 100 billion of them. Neurons collect and process messages by way of electric impulses and send information to other neurons. This is how your brain talks to other parts of your body. Here's how neurons work. Thousands of neurons form pathways that let messages flow through your body. For one neuron to send a message, something must spur it into action. A neuron may relay an impulse to another neuron, or something outside the body, such as the pain of a paper cut or the smell of morning coffee, may cause a neuron to fire off an impulse. From there, the impulse travels like a wave and triggers the release of chemicals. All of this happens so that messages can travel from neuron to neuron and on to other parts of your body. Think of this process as a version of the telephone game you may have played as a child. One child whispers a message into the ear of the child sitting beside him or her, who turns to whisper the message into the next child's ear, and so on, until an entire line of children has received the message and can act on it together. In your brain and nervous system, this process happens at lightning speed and with far greater precision. Damage to or loss of neurons and their connections in the brain results in dementia. In the next sidebar item, not all memory is the same. Here are different types of memory, some that are fleeting and others that are lifelong. These are the most common. Type of memory, episodic memory. How it works? This is a type of memory you have to consciously recall. Episodic memory is your memory of experiences and specific events. Your memories may be different from someone else's recollections of the same experiences. Specific details linked to episodic memory often include feelings, time, and place. experts believe that emotion plays a role in how these memories are formed. Examples of episodic memories may include the birth of a child, graduating from high school, your first date with your spouse, or a vacation a few years back. How long this information is stored? Minutes to years. Semantic memory. This is a type of memory you have to consciously recall. It involves what you know about the world around you. It's a structured record of facts and meanings of words, concepts, and knowledge. These memories may have once had a personal context, but now they stand alone as simple knowledge. It includes things such as an understanding of math, how objects function, definitions of words, knowledge about specific animals, and recalling where a state is located. When older adults say they're having trouble remembering the words for objects and people's names, this is the part of the memory they're often describing. How long this information is stored? Minutes to years. Procedural memory. This is the memory of how to do certain things. These memories are often formed early in life. For example, when you learned to tie your shoes and ride a bike, and later on when you learned to drive a car. These tasks are done over and over and become so ingrained that they are almost automatic and don't require much, if any, conscious thought, and they can last from minutes to years. A working memory. This is your memory for temporarily storing information, so it's readily accessible. Keeping a phone number in your head before dialing it, mentally following a route, or rotating an object in your mind are examples. And this one lasts from seconds to minutes. Information is actively rehearsed or manipulated. And next time we're going to move on to what is cognition. The term cognition comes from a Latin word that means the act of getting to know. It refers to all of the processes of the brain that allow you to think and consciously act, to experience what's going on around you, and to feel emotions. These mental processes involve awareness, perception, judgment, reason, learning, and memory. Cognitive processes are in contrast to the many processes that your body undertakes without your thinking of them, such as breathing and the beating of your heart. You don't have to think in order for those things to happen. Now an article from AARP, the magazine. And this is a series of little essays, and we'll begin with one or two. Finding their heroes. Prominent Americans with roots in Asia or the Pacific Islands talk about and with the elders who inspired them. This is interviews by Ellen Lee and Emily Tan. And we're going to start with one by Greg Louganis on his hero, Duke Kahumaku. Taking a dive into their history. My parents never hid the fact that I was adopted, said Greg Louganis, 61. They told me my birth father was Samoan, but I didn't know what that meant. I only knew that I had darker skin than the other kids. Then, when he was 9 years old, the talented young diver traveled to a competition in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and saw a statue of Duke Kahumaku, the legendary Hawaiian swimmer who died in 1968. I thought, he kind of looks like me, Louganis recalls. I was so gratifying to see that someone I resembled could be a champion. Louganis researched this and learned that he was known not only for his 5 Olympic medals, but for popularizing the sport of surfing, until then largely unknown outside of Hawaii. Having a Pacific Islander to look up to gave Louganis confidence, he adds. Yet it wasn't until he had won 3 of his own 5 Olympic medals that he first connected with his Pacific Island heritage in a personal way. At an appearance in Honolulu, he met his biological father, Fuvail Luchu, who had reluctantly given him up for adoption as an infant 24 years earlier. After more contact with Luchu and his other children, Louganis' half-brother and 2 half-sisters, a bond was established. They're just wonderful, loving, caring people, and I'm grateful to have them in my life, Luganus notes. Now that the parents who raised him have died, Luganus and his husband, Johnny Shiloh, spend Christmases with Lutus. In Waikiki, there's a huge bronze statue of Kaha Nanamoku. When Luganus sees it, he says, "I still feel a connection to him, especially now that I have discovered this part of my heritage." And now let's move on to cooking, hungering for understanding. Padma Lakshmi had known about Madhu Jaffrey since college. A native of Delhi, the elegant Jaffrey broke barriers, first in the UK, then in the US, as an award-winning Shakespearean actress, TV host, and food writer, whose landmark 1973 book, An Invitation to Indian Cooking, is credited with introducing Indian cuisine in the West. "She is a great writer and a great artist," said Lakshmi, 50, who immigrated to the U.S. from India at age 4. "I just never saw a career like that anywhere else. There were not very many Indian women who were known outside of India for anything but being Bollywood actresses. I always admired her ability to be herself and rise." When the two women first met in the early 2000s, Lakshmi's then husband was an old friend of Jaffrey's. Lakshmi's was in the process of inventing her own hyphenate career as a model, actress, writer, food expert. "I still didn't know what my professional life was going to be like," admits the longtime judge on Bravo's Top Chef and host of Hulu's Taste the Nation. "I had a great admiration for Madhur, but I don't think I appreciated her accomplishments then the same way I do today. Now I know what it takes to have done the things she did, especially at the time she achieved them." In Jaffrey, Lakshmi found not only a role model, but a mentor and friend. The older woman had learned to cook as an adult via recipes that her mother mailed to her while she was a theater student in London. So she has a studied and intense relationship with the discipline, an intensity she recognized in Lakshmi. "When Padma really got into food, it was very interesting for me to watch how she explored the area, especially the way she brought attention to cuisines from Asia and around the world," said Jaffrey, 87. "I have a lot of admiration for her for doing this. It's how our relationship grew. The two share a conviction that food is more than just sustenance and sensory pleasure. People often don't take food seriously, but it's a very serious aspect of a culture, because it has roots in history, religion, geography, and just about everything else." Jaffrey notes, "It's an important part of learning about a country, about a people, about every aspect of their lives." Adds Lakshmi, "Food is a way for people to pass their heritage and culture on to their children." Her international cookbook, Tangy, Tart, Hot, and Sweet, was recently re-released in paperback. Asked how she feels about being a pioneer bringing Indian food to American palates, Jaffrey responds that she doesn't think about it much. "I don't focus on being the first," she says. "Instead, I think about people carrying on the work that I started. It needs people to take it in all kinds of new directions. I'm so happy to see Padma carrying on the work in a wonderful way." Now, for the remainder of our time, I'm going back to another article in the AARP, the magazine, the Back to Normal Health Plan for Your 50s. Now, as we all know, these are going to be good for not just 50s, but any age. So step 3 of the plan is eyeball your shut eye. As you might remember from last week, step 2 was square your meals, and step 1 was evaluate your weight. Now onto your shut-eye. A 2020 study of pandemic data from China and Italy found high rates of sleep disruption in the general population throughout the crisis, from acute insomnia to poor sleep hygiene, too much screen time before bed, for example. That can do more than drag us down. It can directly relate to cardiovascular disease. Agarwal says. The key question, am I getting through the day without fatigue? If you're falling short of quality and consistency in sleep, it's going to show up in the way you feel throughout the day. Test yourself. Bedtime consistency. Each morning, write down what time you fell asleep the night before, whether you woke up in the night, what time you woke up, and whether you woke up with the aid of an alarm. Then, whenever you make an entry into your food journal, rate how much energy you feel on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being ready to climb Mount Everest, and 1 being ready to fall down. Patterns to look for. Are you on a routine? Agarwal defines a regular sleep schedule as falling asleep and waking up within the same 45 to 60 minute window each day. Anything outside of that raises your risk of hypertension and diabetes. The pandemic has made it easy to be lax in the name of binge watching and no morning commute. Maybe we stay up just a little bit later, and we may sleep in just a little bit. Agarwal says, these disruptions in circadian rhythm can also put you at risk for weight gain. If you don't get enough quality sleep, you're more likely to gain weight. And if you are overweight, you're more likely to not sleep well. Is your sleeping influencing your eating? A study of nearly 500 women up to age 76 found that lower quality sleep was linked to greater food intake and poor diet. Conversely, a study in nutrients found that a diet high in healthier fare was associated with higher sleep quality and fewer sleep disturbances. Eating more fruits, vegetables, and legumes did the trick. Now we have a sidebar article at the bottom of this page, Brain Drain. Are your newfound memory issues a dementia warning sign? Not necessarily considering what the past year was like, prolonged stress can increase inflammation and the levels of stress hormones like cortisol in your body. Growing research has linked high stress and cortisol to short-term memory loss. So it's possible that your recent memory issues could just be another thing to chalk up to 2020. As life returns to normal, so should your stress and memory levels. Exercise can also help. More on that later. The question is, how bad is the memory loss? Briefly forgetting a name is less of a concern than forgetting who someone is. Now, going back to the issue of when you fall asleep, do you fall outside 6 and 9? Getting fewer than 6 hours or more than 9 hours of sleep daily is a red flag and a sign of an underlying sleep disorder, like insomnia or apnea. More red flags. Not feeling rested when you wake up, daytime sleepiness, and irritability. Do you now need a pill to sleep better? Occasional help from an over-the-counter sleep aid or melatonin is fine, but if you're taking it more than once a week, you're doing yourself more harm than good. You may have some underlying sleep issues you aren't addressing, and those products aren't designed for chronic long-term use. That's true even for natural remedies like melatonin. If you're taking melatonin over the counter, that could make your sleep worse over time if you're not speaking to your doctor about it. Melatonin is typically used for short cases like jet lag. It's not meant to be a long-term solution. Here's a question. What's your chronotype? Your chronotype is your preferred time of day for normal activities. Night owls have an evening chromatine. Type. The majority of people fall into the morning or intermediate chronotypes. One study of more than 500 women found that morning and intermediate people tend to have better health habits, have better sleep habits, be less sedentary, and have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease than night owls. Step 4. Where your head's at. Yes, the pandemic is making you crazy, at least according to a 2021 report from Mental Health America, which screened 1.5 million Americans from January to September 2020. It found that 8 out of 10 respondents were experiencing moderate to severe symptoms of anxiety and depression. Those rates rose as the year progressed. The key question, on any given day, am I sadder or angrier than I was before the pandemic? Poor mood is one of the first indicators that we're not processing stress the way we should, said David H. Rosmarin, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Stress is an imbalance between resources and demands, so when you have fewer resources and more demands, you're going to feel more stressed. Test yourself. The depression scale. Researchers at Columbia University developed the Patient Health Questionnaire, a screening tool to measure levels of depression. We have a version for you to take in this article. If you score 10 or higher, it may be worth looking into treatment. Before you jump to any conclusions about your mental health, though, let's put things in perspective. Everyone is going to have a crabby week from time to time, Rosmarin said, but if symptoms persist more than 30 days, you really need to reach out for help. Ask yourself, do you have low energy or low-grade physical pain? A lack of motivation along with physical problems such as back pain or headaches that aren't associated with any injury or medical condition and that persist for more than 30 days are definitely worth discussing, Rosmarin said, and might have more of a mental ideology to them. Are you still having fun, all things considered? An inability to feel pleasure is a warning sign and a classic symptom of major depression. 2020 sucked the joy out of many things, but if you or a loved one quits doing something for a month or more that was once cherished, you need to find out why. How do you judge your reaction to stress? If I interpret my stress reaction as, oh, I'm a weak person, something's wrong with me, that's going to make life a heck of a lot worse, Rosmarin said. Why are you here? This is less religion and more about understanding that there's ultimate meaning, Rosmarin says. For some, just the idea of having meaning and purpose helps them get through the most difficult times. Are there still dreams and hopes and wishes that you have yet to fulfill? How can you get there? So next time we'll continue this article and we'll look at the depression scale quiz that I mentioned earlier. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.